So this is work with Ofer Aharoni, Joe Marzano, Shiraz Manuala, Kyriakos Papadotimus, and Toby Meisman. So some combination of these people are on each of these papers, including one to appear. So the motivations. Actually, I'm never sure what. Depending on the audience, I could start from the top or the bottom. Maybe for this audience, I'll start from the bottom. So of course. We're interested in gauge theories because large n gauge theories are at least some of them are dual to string theories, maybe a lot of them. So if we want to understand interesting things about thermodynamics and gravitational systems, then we can hope to learn about these things from large n theories using gauge theory gravity duality. If you were more boring and say only interested in gauge theories, then you'd be interested in thermodynamics. For general reasons, just because different degrees of freedom can actually be important at different temperatures. So if you just understand the zero temperature physics of a gauge theory, then you might be missing a lot of the interesting part of the story. And if you're the type of person that's actually interested in the real world, then there are also various reasons to be interested in the thermodynamics of gauge theories. So for example, we have QCD in the real world. And it's believed that early in the universe, in the first 10 to the minus 5 seconds, we actually had kind of a dramatic change in behavior of this QCD part of our theory, where we went from, we believe, some quark gluon plasma type phase to the present phase where all of the color charge is confined into hadrons. Okay. So more recently than that, another example where understanding these things is important, is to understand what's going on at the relativistic heavy ion collider. People believe that they may have reproduced something like this quark gluon plasma phase that was present in the early universe by colliding heavy nuclei together at very high energy. So to understand what's going on and to interpret the results of those experiments, you'd like to understand actually in a quantitative way what the physics of these different phases of gauge theories would be. Another example, if you think about, actually for both of these examples, if you think about not only finite temperature, but turning on some chemical potential, so for example you have finite baryon density, then this is presumably important also in, say, the interiors of neutron stars. There's, I think, no consensus on what exactly the physics is there. Okay. So in this talk, I'm actually going to start with the simplest gauge theory that we can talk about. So just pure Yang-Mills theory. I won't talk about any quarks for now. And we'll talk about the gauge group SUN. And I'll just review a little bit about what we know about this theory in flat space. So I want to take pure gauge theory in flat space, turn on the temperature, and ask what happens. Okay. Well, we believe, and if you can prove this, you get $1 million or something like that. We believe that at low temperatures, this theory is confined, so all of the degrees of freedom are bound into glue ball type states. Okay. At some critical temperature, we believe that there's a phase transition up into a deconfined phase where the gluons are liberated. Okay. So this is not something we can establish analytically right now. But numerical work gives compelling evidence, and we can also actually ask about what the details of this phase transition are, and they actually change depending on whether depending on the value of n. So for n equals 2, it's believed, or it seems from numerical simulations, to be a smooth transition, a second order transition. While for n equals 3 or greater than 3, it seems to be first order behavior. So the free energy has a discontinuous derivative. Okay. So the reason that we can't establish these things analytically is because at this temperature, these theories are strongly coupled. Okay. So we don't really have any available analytic methods. The point of this talk is going to be kind of to ask, well, are there situations where you can understand these phase transitions in detail analytically without having to resort to numerics? So one of the main ideas is going to be that asymptotic freedom, the idea that at high energies things get simpler in a large class of these interesting gauge theories. If you think about that idea, then you can convince yourself that things should actually be simpler if instead of thinking about the infinite volume gauge theory, you put it on a finite finite volume compact space. Okay, so this is essentially, so imagine we have our gauge theory on a sphere. This essentially gives us an infrared cutoff on the theory. Okay, so you're pushing the energy of the lowest modes up and up and up, and so at least naively, if the size of that space, okay, so if the energy of the KK modes is high enough, or if the size of the space is small enough, okay, then you can basically push your infrared cutoff way above the dynamical scale of the gauge theory, okay, in which case you should be in a regime where things are weakly coupled. So that's going to be, we're going to see to what extent that's true. And so one other thing I should say before we rush into doing this is that as soon as I put one of these gauge theories on a finite volume, that if we're not at large n, so if we just have an ordinary field theory with sort of a locally finite number of fields, then basically just general arguments tell you that all of these transitions that happen at infinite volume have to be smoothed out. Okay, so if I have a field theory and it's on a finite volume, and I imagine, so I have some infrared cutoff, and if I'm at some particular energy scale, there's really only a finite number of degrees of freedom that are accessible to us. So it's really just like a quantum mechanics theory, and in that kind of a theory, you can't really have any sharp phase transitions. Okay, so for this talk, I'm always going to be talking about large N theories. Okay, where the behavior is allowed to remain sharp even if we're at finite volume. Okay. So just to put that in perspective, I'll just remind you that it seems that the qualitative behavior at infinite volume is similar for n equals 3 and anything higher than 3. So hopefully studying the large N theory will not take us too far away from, say, more physically interesting examples where n would be equal to 3. So the first example I'm going to look at, and I'm going to work through in some detail, will be to study just the simplest, this large N Yuan-Yang-Mills theory without any matter, and I'm going to take it on kind of the simplest compact space I can think of, so a topologically trivial S3. Okay, so I want to imagine my field theory on a sphere, I want to turn up the temperature to various values and ask about what the physics is. Okay, so this is a kind of the phase diagram that we want to fill in. This theory has two parameters. So there's the radius of the sphere, and to give you some dimensionless object, I can write that in units of the scale of the gauge theory. Okay. So what we said before is that if this radius goes to infinity, okay, and by infinity we really just expect that we should have to take the radius to be much larger than the typical length scale, so say the size of a glue ball. Okay, if I take that radius very large, then it should behave like the infinite volume theory, and there I argued that you have a phase transition, or numerical evidence suggests that we have a first order phase transition at the temperature equal to some multiple of this phase of the gauge theory. So the reason it doesn't look like a constant, it's a straight line because I've chosen to measure the temperature using a dimensionless quantity which is in units of the inverse radius of the sphere. Okay. So the one dimensionless quantity is our temperature in units of the radius, and the other dimensionless quantity is the size of the sphere in units of the dynamical scale. So this is the strongly coupled region. This is large volume. And by the arguments from the previous transparency, we might expect that over here, where the sphere actually gets very small, that you might be able to understand things analytically. Okay, so this should be weakly coupled. And we should actually be able to do some perturbative calculations. So that's what we're going to try to do. Okay. So because we want to understand thermodynamics, then the standard thing to do is, well, to compute the partition function. Okay. So in the next slide, I'll talk about some order parameters and how from this partition function we can actually extract the information about whether the theory is confined or deconfined. Okay? But just to remind you that if we have basically any thermodynamic system, then the definition is that we sum over all of the states and we take the Boltzmann factor, e to the minus beta times the energy of the state. Okay, so it's no different than any other system. And when we have a field theory on this S3, on this compact space, it's really just a discrete spectrum. Okay, so this sum is not, so I'm not implying any kind of integration here. It's really just a sum over over states. Now there's a fancy way to compute this if we want to use path integrals in field theory. And that is to say that the thermal partition function is equivalent to taking the Euclidean version of the theory, okay, so taking the time, continuing it to be Euclidean, so we take the Euclidean version of the theory and compute the path integral over where we take a circle for the time direction. Okay, so we take, I mean, basically this comes from the fact that the partition function is sort of the expectation value of e to the minus beta h. That looks like an evolution operator where the time is imaginary and we evolve for a time beta and then demand that we're back to the same thing because we want to take the trace. Okay. So probably everyone's familiar with that statement. Okay, so that's the object that we're going to try and compute. But first we want to ask, well, how do I know when the theory is actually confined? So suppose I could actually compute this. What am I actually looking for? Okay. So there are various order parameters that people have used to talk about confinement. And actually, so here there are two that will be relevant for us. Okay. Now, the usual one that people talk about, say doing these numerical simulations, if we're at infinite volume or finite volume, and we just have finite n, the usual thing to ask is, if I put in a single external quark into the theory, okay, what is the free energy of that relative to the ordinary vacuum state, how much does it increase the free energy to put in a quark? Okay, so physically, the expectation is that if we're in a confined phase, okay, so if we have all color charge bound into singlets and we try to put in an extra charged object, so we an extra quark, then the flux from that quark, well, it can't just stop in the middle of space, it has to either end somewhere or go off to infinity, and since there aren't really any other free charges around, it doesn't have any place to end, and so essentially you have to have some infinitely long tube of this flux that would correspond to an infinite amount of energy. So trying to put in a quark in a confined theory is difficult, so the free energy is actually infinite, and this object will go to zero. Okay. In a deconfined theory, we have free charges floating around. We have, in this case, free gluons moving around in our plasma, and so the flux from an external quark could actually just end on some nearby gluon. So you can actually see that inserting a single quark only requires you to add, say, a finite amount of energy to your system, and so the expectation value, or the free energy here is finite, and this thing is non-zero. Okay, so this is a good order parameter because it's zero in the confined phase, non-zero in the deconfined phase. Okay, how do we actually compute it? Well, it turns out that it's related to the expectation value of an operator, which is the integral of the gauge field around this thermal circle. Okay. Now, there's kind of a nice way to see that. If we go back to think about electricity and magnetism, where if I wanted to insert into the action for electricity and magnetism a single external electron, well, what's the term coupling the electron to the gauge field? It's just the integral of the one-form gauge field along the world line of the electron. Okay, so that's basically all we're doing here, except that we're talking about a non-abelian gauge theory. We have a quark instead of an electron, but we're still just integrating the gauge field around this time direction because the quark is just sitting there. Okay, so it's just propagating around the time direction. Okay, so there's a technical point that someone could ask me about later if you want. When we're actually on a compact space, there are some kind of trivial reasons why this actually always vanishes, but it doesn't matter. We can just compute the expectation value of that Polyakov loop. So this is called the Polyakov loop. We can compute the expectation value of the norm squared of that thing, and that's non-zero, and will be just as good an order parameter. Okay. Okay. So that's kind of the standard order parameter for confinement. If we're talking about a large N theory, then we actually have another order parameter for confinement. Okay? So the idea, again, is very physical. If we're in this deconfined phase with free quarks floating around, then there were free gluons floating around. There are n squared kinds of gluons. Okay? And so if we just think about some kind of ideal gas approximation or something where the quarks are not interacting very strongly, then it's very plausible that the free energy should depend like n squared. Okay, so if we have n squared different degrees of freedom, then we're going to just have some factor of n squared outside. And so in the deconfined phase, then the free energy goes like order n squared. If we're in a confined phase, then all of the gluons are bound into glue balls, and the number of those doesn't depend on it really doesn't depend on n. So it kind of looks the same. We don't see the color charge at all. So in this case, the free energy is not order n squared. It's basically order one. Okay. So depending on whether we have glue balls as the sort of free degrees of freedom or gluons, we have two different dependences on n for the free energy, and therefore this free energy divided by n squared should be a good order parameter for our confinement. Okay. Actually, towards the end of the talk, we'll see an example where these two things are different, but for now, they'll actually turn out to be the same in our first example on the sphere. Okay, so let's actually do the calculation. So I have my gauge theory, it's on a sphere. I want to calculate the path integral over all configurations where the gauge field is periodic around this thermal circle. To do that, okay, in practice I have to do a couple of technical steps. So the usual integral over all possible values of A would be redundant because some of them are related to each other by gauge transformations. So I have to fix a gauge, and a convenient thing to do is to choose the Coulomb gauge for the spatial part of the gauge field. Okay, that fixes part of the gauge freedom. There's some remaining gauge symmetry that I can fix by then taking the zero mode of this time component on the sphere. Okay, so I have the time component of the gauge field. The zero mode of that on the sphere is something that then depends on time, and we can choose that to be constant, and that's another gauge condition. So another way to write it is just that the zero mode of A0 on the sphere is a constant, and that's going to be a very important degree of freedom for us, so I'll give it a name and I'll call it alpha. Okay, so alpha is the zero mode of A0. Okay, so the reason that this is important is if I think about expanding out all of these fields in terms of mode, so now I've fixed a gauge, but I still have many degrees of freedom left over. These are fields on the sphere that satisfy these conditions. If I have a function on a sphere, then the natural thing to do is expand it out in terms of some kind of spherical harmonics. In this case, we have, vector spherical harmonics in three dimensions rather than the standard two-dimensional spherical harmonics, but it's the same idea. So we convert our fields into these various modes, and now the theory looks a lot like some quantum mechanics of an infinite number of modes, but the point is that except for this one zero mode, except for this alpha degree of freedom, all these things are very massive when the sphere is very small. Okay. So we have this one degree of freedom that's basically going to remain light, and then everything else is going to get more and more massive and basically couple less and less as the size of the sphere goes down to zero size. Okay. So the natural thing to do is then integrate out these heavy things and come up with an effective action for the light thing. Okay. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to integrate everything else out and come up with an effective action for alpha. Okay. So this is a more accurate version of something I wrote down a couple of slides ago. So the partition function now is an integral just over the degrees of freedom that have not been gauge fixed away. So I have an integral over alpha, and then an integral over A prime, which is just the remaining degrees of freedom. I have to include some Fadeyev pop-up determinant for each of those gauge fixing conditions. Okay. So one of them, the one corresponding to this guy, doesn't depend on A prime, it just depends on alpha. And then there's another one corresponding to this gauge fixing condition that we can write in the usual way using ghosts. So if I expand that out, then I'll have an integral over some ghosts, and I'll have a ghost action here. But the point is I'm going to do all of these integrals and be left with just an integral over alpha. Okay. So then actually some nice structure comes out. Okay, so I want to do this integral, and it turns out that instead of some general function of alpha, so alpha is some Hermitian matrix, instead of some general function of that, actually the effective action I get only depends on a unitary matrix U, which is the exponential of alpha. Okay. Another interpretation for U, so we've assumed that this A0 field is constant around the thermal circle, but if I write it more generally, then this exponential of alpha, well, this is actually something I talked about before. It's basically equivalent just to the integral of A0 around the thermal circle, since this thing was supposed to be constant. Okay. So we should think of this U as being related to our Polyakov loop order parameter. So the trace of U is basically going to play the role of that order parameter. Okay. So we'll actually be interested in the behavior of U in this theory, so it's kind of nice that the theory reduces just to an effective action for that order parameter. Okay. So that's what happens here. Fortunately, it turns out that the measure, okay, because of the combination of this determinant and this measure factor there, the measure also turns into just the usual measure, the invariant measure on the set of unitary matrices. Okay. So this is our partition function. We integrate everything out except alpha, and then it turns out what we're left with is an integral over the set of unitary matrices, over this exponential of alpha, and then some effective action that depends just on U. In fact, it just, by gauge invariance, it just depends on the eigenvalues of U, which are things that sit on a unit circle. Okay, so the thing to take away from this slide is that our partition function then reduces to a unitary matrix model, which is an effective action for our Polyakov loop. Okay, so now we'll see what that actually looks like. Actually, it doesn't necessarily require that R is explicitly zero. So what we're going to do is first calculate it in that limit, and then we'll perturb around it and find that we still have this. We still have this structure. So nothing here formally assumes that we're at R equals zero. It's just less and less intelligent to do that kind of reduction when the KK modes become more and more strongly coupled. That's right, yeah. Okay, so what does it look like? So what does the actual result look like? So this integral that we're doing over the A prime fields, basically we're just computing it's sort of the vacuum path integral. Okay, so the types of diagrams we're computing are really just vacuum diagrams, except that this alpha field or the U field is something like a background field when we're doing our vacuum diagrams. Okay, so perturbation theory should apply. Okay, we have a coupling in the theory. It's completely justified to do perturbation theory as long as our sphere is small, and so we should expect that the leading contribution when the sphere is very small is just this one loop diagram. Okay, that turns out to have a very simple answer. Okay, so what I'm going to do is define some other version of the temperature. So X is just something that goes to zero at low temperatures and one at high temperatures. Okay. And then our theory, so at lambda goes to zero, where the interactions turn off, the unitary matrix model that I promised looks exactly like this. Okay, so it's actually just a theory with two traces. The fact that it has only two traces comes from the fact that you have two index lines there. Okay, so each index line corresponds to a trace, and so you have all possible two trace terms, and the coefficients of those are actually all related to each other. And this f of x here, so this is a function of temperature that actually has a very simple interpretation. It's really just the partition function for the single particle modes. So when I expand my field into modes on the sphere, those have various energies, and if I sum over all the modes and put in this Boltzmann factor, that's the definition of f of x. Okay, yes? Oh yes, that's right. So I should explain that more. Okay. So there's actually a symmetry So I could have had something like trace U plus trace U dagger or something like that. The reason that I don't have anything like that is that there's a center symmetry. So there's Right. There's a symmetry which of the theory which takes U to an element of the center of the Grage group, so just some nth root of unity times U. Okay. And yeah, no, it's just the original theory that we started with had a symmetry. Okay, actually, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's just a symmetry of the original theory that that manifests itself by a selection rule here. Okay. Good. Okay. So the only thing you really need to know about this f is that, well, from here it's obvious that it's some monotonically increasing function. All of these terms are positive. So it starts at zero at low temperatures and increases to infinity at infinite temperature. Okay. This is the explicit form for pure Yang-Mills theory. Okay. So how do we do this integral? Well, here's where large N is going to come in and help us. Okay. So actually, this is something that people studied over and over again 20 years ago. So there are many techniques for doing matrix integrals in large N. So the idea is that in the large N limit, where the number of these eigenvalues goes to infinity, this integral over all of the possible configurations of eigenvalues is completely dominated by the minimum of the minimum action configuration. Okay. So all we have to do to evaluate this at large N, or at least to get the leading order contribution, is to figure out what is the favored configuration of eigenvalues at any particular temperature, and then just evaluate the integrand at that favored configuration. Okay. So this is the saddle point technique. So to do that, it's useful to introduce the eigenvalue density. Okay, since we have an infinite number of eigenvalues on a unit circle, we can talk about those in terms of a continuous function, which tells me how many eigenvalues I have in a little interval of theta. Okay. And then more specifically, what I'm going to do is to rewrite this whole theory in terms of the Fourier components of this eigenvalue density. Okay, so instead of working with a continuous function, I'll expand it out into its Fourier modes. And it turns out that this whole action then comes down and reduces to actually just a Gaussian integral over those degrees of freedom. Okay. So what are the terms in this Gaussian integral? Well, I have something which just comes from what I had up here. Okay, so this f times trace u dagger comes right down here. So trace u to the n is actually the same thing as this Fourier mode of the eigenvalue distribution. Okay. Then I have this extra term here, which comes from the Jacobian in converting from this measure to the simple measure over those UNs. Okay. So I have a Gaussian integral, and then the important thing is going to be whether all of these coefficients are positive or whether some of them are negative. Okay. So that's sort of the two behaviors that so I have a product of Gaussian integrals, and so a Gaussian integral can either have a positive coefficient or a negative one, and that's what we'll want to look at. Okay, good. So we've reduced everything to a Gaussian integral, which is kind of the goal of physics, I think. So here we go. I've just rewritten that, and now we'll analyze it. Okay. So what happens at low temperatures? Okay. Now I told you that f of x was equal to zero at low temperatures. Okay. So when f of x is equal to zero, this coefficient here is manifestly positive. A physical way to understand it is just that the measure factor for a unitary matrix model tends to prefer the eigenvalues spread out over the circle rather than bunched up. Okay, so this is standard lore in these matrix models. Okay, so at small temperature, when f is small, or actually all it has to be is smaller than one, all of these coefficients are going to be positive. And so all of the Gaussian integrals will be ordinary ones whose maximum, so the integrand will be maximum when all of the UNs are equal to zero. Okay. Great. So all of these UNs are zero. So to a first approximation, our free energy, okay, the log of the partition function, is just going to be zero. Okay. So this whole n squared term just vanishes. And then I have to do the next approximation in my saddle point, which is to actually do the Gaussian integral around that point. Okay. That Gaussian integral gives me something of order one. So what I find is that the free energy over n squared is just zero. Okay, so the leading approximation is zero. The result is that the free energy is of order one, but our order parameter is f over n squared, and so it's just zero. Okay. Similarly, the trace of u, our Polyakov loop, well, that's just u1, and since all of these u's are zero on our saddle point, then that Polyakov loop order parameter is also zero. Okay, so for low temperatures, we've seen that the theory is confined. Now what happens as we increase the temperature? Well, remember our f function increased from 0 up to infinity, so at some point it's going to hit 1. Okay. And when it hits 1, okay, so when f of x, actually we have a bunch of terms here. The first one that's going to hit 1 is just the first term, because x is always less than x squared and x cubed. Okay. So when f of x hits 1, then the first of these modes, the u1 mode, is going to become unstable. So it condenses, okay, so one of these coefficients is then negative, and then instead of a positive Gaussian integral, you have a negative one, and so, you know, to minimize the action, the U1 mode is going to want to become as large as it can. Okay. So what does that actually mean? Well, the U1 is the first Fourier mode of this eigenvalue distribution, right? So we'll go from a constant distribution to one where the U1 turns on, we'll get this the sine mode, just the wavelength 1 mode, turning on as much as it can, but once the eigenvalue distribution hits 0, it can't condense anymore. Okay, so it's actually a compact space that we're integrating over here, and we end up with this configuration. Okay, as we increase the temperature further, okay, it actually becomes advantageous to turn on some of these higher UN modes, just in order that U1 could become even bigger. And so the physical picture is that the eigenvalue distribution becomes more and more peaked. It actually develops, it's actually zero for most of this interval and is peaked at one point. Okay. So this is the high temperature behavior. And you can see, well, first of all, since U1 is not zero, then this whole factor is going to be non-zero. It's going to be proportional to n squared. So our f over n squared order parameter is going to be finite, non-zero. And similarly, we've just argued that U1 turns on, so our Polyakov loop order parameter is now non-zero. And so by both criteria, we're now in a deconfined phase.
Sorry, can you just repeat why
the order n squared? Okay. So the free energy is the log of this partition function. Okay. The saddle point approximation is just to evaluate this integrand on the minimum action configuration. Okay. So now U1 is non-zero, so this is non-zero, and because I have this factor of n squared sitting out in front, it's order n squared. That's right, yeah, so I should say that. Right, so U1 is as big as it can possibly be, and that turns out to be a half. Yes, that's right. So that's actually how it works. So, and that's going to be a little bit important later. So, if as soon as I increase the temperature above this, then this actually pinches, and so the support becomes some finite interval on the circle.
So the support is a finite interval at any epsilon above this?
At any epsilon above this, yes. So, and this is something you could, it's famous. It happens in a matrix model that Gross and Witten studied 25 years ago. Which is trace U plus trace U dagger, and there what happens is at their transition they also have some phase transition. You start out at this point and then it pinches down.
But so it's happening when just the first mode condenses before the second mode condenses.
That's right. So you can think of this is the U1 direction. So the U2 direction is still quite positive. So when it condenses, this is fairly flat. Okay, so we still don't want to turn on U2 very much, but as you go to higher temperatures, this gets more negative. Okay, and so we can actually do better by So it turns out the boundary of this space. So I can avoid this I can satisfy this positivity requirement. I can make U1 actually a bit bigger than it was here. I can actually increase it as long as I turn on U2 a little bit. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, it's okay. So the only thing that we'll need is that it is, so this is u equals 0. So un is equal to 0 is an interior point of this space. The space is compact. Okay. So we can think about, say, this is being the u1 direction and say this is being the u2 direction. Okay. So when the u1 direction becomes, when this becomes flat and unstable, what we want to do is go out to the boundary of the configuration space. Okay. So this boundary is defined by rho of theta is greater than or equal to 0. Okay. So when u1 becomes unstable, we go out to the boundary of the configuration space. So we've condensed this sine mode all the way down to where the function is 0 at one point. Okay. As we increase the temperature further, then this u1 mode becomes even more, now it's really negative. And so what we want to do is actually move along the boundary in such a way to increase u1 at the expense of turning on a little bit of u2. Okay, so it's exactly how I've drawn it. We can get a little bit further along this u1 direction by increasing u2, even though u2 is still energetically, it would rather be 0. Okay. Okay, so that's probably more detail than you need to know about, but that's the picture, I think. Okay.
So how do you know that for any given theory it will look like that? I mean, could it be that somehow?
Well, this is theory independent. This is just the space of, I mean, this picture is just the space of, you can think of it just as the space of functions on a circle. Okay.
And
yeah, the only thing that depends, so the potential on this space depends a little bit on the field content and the gauge group, but it actually doesn't really at this level, at this one loop level, hardly anything matters. The only thing that mattered, okay, was the fact that this function f of x was monotonically increasing and hit 1 sometime between 0 and 1. And that turns out to be true as long as you have more than one mode. Okay, so if even if I'm talking about a complex Hermitian matrix model, no, that doesn't make sense. A two Hermitian matrix model or a complex matrix model in 0 plus 1 dimensions, the same behavior will happen. Okay, so it's actually very very insensitive at this point to the details of the theory. Okay, so that's why I want to get to the next slide. Okay, so just to summarize what we've shown, as we increase the temperature at some point, the eigenvalue distribution, the eigenvalues clump, the free energy turns on, so the free energy over n squared becomes non-zero. Here it's just order 1. And the Polyakov loop develops an expectation value, so it jumps out to the boundary of this configuration space, and then actually slowly increases to 1, which is the maximum value that it can have anywhere in the configuration space. Okay, so we have a first-order deconfinement transition. But that's actually true just for... So that's for lambda equals 0, strictly. It turns out that if we turn on the couplings, so if we think about the contributions of higher loop diagrams, or lambda not equals to 0, then whether it's a first-order transition or a second-order transition actually depends on exactly what those corrections do. Okay, so I'd like to explain that now. Okay. Oops. Okay. So when we go to the next order, well, we'll have some two-loop diagrams and some three-loop diagrams at the next order. These are going to lead to higher trace terms in the effective action. Okay, because the number of traces is the number of index lines. And so those traces of u's, those were basically our variables for the effective action. So those terms of 3 traces or 4 traces are going to lead to terms that are cubic in our, so before we just had a Gaussian integral, now we're going to have cubic terms in these un's and quartic terms in the un's. Okay, and those can actually change change what happens. Okay. So the reason is that before, when I just had a Gaussian integral, if any of the coefficients become negative, then the U's want to become as large as they possibly can. Okay, because there's no higher order term that would say, you know, slow down, we've got a quartic term here. Okay. So now once I have these interactions coming into play, then I can have terms that may prevent U1 from condensing as much as possible. Okay. So what we have to do is actually compute these. The main thing we're interested in is actually just this U1. That was what controlled our phase transition. So what I could actually do is kind of integrate out all the other ones. Okay. So in the end, what I want to do is ask, what is the U1 to the fourth term in this effective action for U1? Okay. So this mu was the thing that became negative at our critical temperature. And now the point is that if this term is positive, okay, that's going to prevent us from flowing off, from condensing as much as possible. Okay, so if we have a positive quartic term, then the effective potential as a function of temperature, well, it starts out everything is monotonically increasing. When that U1 mode becomes unstable, we don't go off as far as we can. It actually just sort of slowly increases as the temperature increases. So this is what the effective potential looks like as a function of temperature with a positive B. Okay. And so what that means is instead of U1 jumping from 0 to a half, it actually just gradually increases. And the free energy in this case has a continuous first derivative. Okay. So in the B greater than 0 case, what we would find is that you actually have a second order transition. Okay. So now, so this is kind of useful. So it turns out in that case that you also necessarily have a higher order transition as well. Okay. And that's easy to see from this diagram. Okay. So there, at the critical temperature, I start going off gradually in this direction. As I increase the temperature, eventually I hit the boundary of configuration space and then move off there. And this is actually something that's mildly discontinuous. So the third derivative of the free energy turns out to be discontinuous. Or in the eigenvalue picture, I start out like this. As I increase the temperature, I just gradually turn on this mode. At some point, I have a zero here, and then I go off into this range where I have a gap on the circle. Okay. So that's one possibility, depending on what the value of this B is. The other possibility is that B is negative. Okay. And then, well, there's nothing to stop U1 from condensing as far as it wants. In fact, it'll condense even before the quadratic term becomes unstable. Okay, so as a function of temperature, if my quartic term actually is negative, then what's going to happen is even before this point where it becomes unstable, a new minimum will develop, and so I will have a jump in U1, and I'll still have a first order transition. Okay, so these are the two possibilities to keep in mind. This is the region of kind of intermediate coupling. Okay. So what we're doing here is starting out from lambda is equal to zero and perturbing away. So our results are going to tell us sort of what happens in the neighborhood of lambda is equal to zero. This is lambda is equal to one. So we can't really do any analytic calculations. In principle, you could do numerics, but the numerics have essentially been done for very large, effectively infinite volume because people were interested in flat space. Okay. So it's interesting, if this were realized, we'd have to ask the question, well, what on earth happens in between that connects up all of these phase transition lines? Okay. In the other possibility, it's a little bit simpler because we could just imagine that the first order behavior remains all the way through. Okay. Okay, so, well, how do we distinguish? We have to do this. We have to do these perturbative calculations. Okay. So what we want is this B. That comes from a term trace U to the fourth. And in order to get that term, we're actually going to need to do a three-loop calculation because three-loop diagrams have four index lines, and that's what we need to get four traces. Okay. Okay, so we've actually done this three-loop calculation for pure Yang-Mills on a sphere. So you have various diagrams. It takes a while to compute them. And when you're done, what you find is that B is equal to minus 5.8 times 10 to the minus 4. Okay, so B is actually negative in the simplest example of pure Yang mills on a sphere. So the conclusion for this part is that for pure Yang mills theory on S3, that we've now been able to analytically establish that there's a first order phase transition at small volume, and we can compute what the transition temperature is, and we found that it's first order. Okay, so I think that's quite interesting. If, as it seems natural, this is just connected all the way from small coupling to large coupling, then we have an analytic understanding of really the same phase transition that's occurring at infinite volume. Okay, so this is the confinement deconfinement transition that, well, at least for n equals 3, you probably get $1 million for understanding. Okay, so here you're over in a different regime where it's compact space, but it looks like it may be actually the same phase transition line. Okay, so if you didn't know this part of the picture, then at least you might predict that, well, this thing can't just end. We have an order parameter distinguishing the two sides, so either it would have to hit the axis somewhere, asymptote somewhere, or you'd have to have a phase transition at strong coupling. Okay, so the conjecture would be, the simplest conjecture would be that it's the same. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a few generalizations. So actually, everything I said essentially goes through unchanged if I add arbitrary adjoint matter. Okay, so in terms of I still get exactly the same form of the effective action at zero coupling. I still get this one loop result that you have a first order phase transition. And in principle, I could go ahead and do the same kinds of calculations to establish whether it's first order or second order. Okay, so that's true with arbitrary adjoint matter. Actually, it's true for any space as long as you don't have any zero modes. Okay, so it's true in these quantum mechanics examples where I have a complex scalar matrix. Okay, or on a two-dimensional sphere. It doesn't work when I have zero modes. So if I'm on a torus instead of a sphere, then the analysis is more complicated, and I'll get to that shortly. Okay. So at least in this larger class of things, lambda equals zero, exactly the same behavior. Okay. The phase transition occurs when this particular function is equal to one, and then for lambda greater than zero, well, it's going to depend. So there, we actually used all of the interaction vertices. We had to do a calculation, and so the behavior is going to depend on the details of the theory. Okay, so then it's an interesting general question, I think, to ask, well, which space-times, or which spaces, and which matter content gives B greater than zero, and which gives B less than zero? Okay, so now, any theory in this class is going to go down one of these roads, and so it might be interesting in general to understand, which ones are over here, which ones are over here, because those are really quite different behaviors in the phase diagram. Now, of course, I've only told you about one example, and so you might conjecture that all theories have B less than zero. It turns out that I can prove to you that there are examples with B greater than zero without doing another three-loop calculation. So I'll give you two examples. So it's a really simple argument that you can have theories with B greater than zero. Okay. So I want to go to my simplest possible example. This is the complex scalar matrix in 0 plus 1 dimensions. Okay. So I have an ordinary kinetic term. It's a gauged theory. That's important. I have a mass term. And then I'm going to imagine that we have 4th, 6th, and 8th order terms in the potential. Okay, so the point is that if I have a 6th order term, okay, then I have a 3-loop diagram, okay, or some contribution to trace u to the 4th that is linear in the coefficient here. Okay, that means that whatever I get from all of these other diagrams, so I compute all of my other three-loop diagrams, they contribute something to B, but then I have something that's linear in this coefficient, and so by dialing that coefficient, I'm always going to be able to choose it, either sufficiently positive or sufficiently negative, in order to get B to be positive. Okay. Yeah. That's right. So I might have to make C6 very negative, okay? But as long as I have a theory with at least an eighth order interaction, then I can, you know, I can ensure that everything is non-perturbatively well defined, okay? So this example, right, obviously it's not as nice to use this example in four dimensions where this wouldn't be renormalizable, okay? So then the conjecture could be that, well, maybe all theories in four dimensions have B less than zero. Well, there's actually another similar argument that shows you if you have a two trace term in your action, okay, so if I have this term trace phi squared, then I can actually get four index lines even with a two loop diagram. Okay, so the same argument then shows you that that I could get B to be positive by dialing this coefficient. And actually, you can show fairly easily that if I have a trace phi to the fourth term and I chose the coefficient there to be large enough, that can always make sure this potential is positive definite. Okay. So now I guess the remaining question is, are there any single trace theories in two or three dimensions that have positive B? I have a student that's working out the 2+1 dimensional case. It's actually not you can carry over a lot of the results from 3+1 dimensions. Okay, so I think there's an interesting specific example here of this general class of theories, and that is the maximally supersymmetric gauge theory on S3. This is the one that is supposed to be dual to type 2B superstring theory on ADS5 cross S5. Okay. So good. So this is not a confining theory. It's a conformal field theory. So it's not your typically, it's not like the asymptotically free theories that I was talking about earlier. And in fact, if I think about varying the size of the space, then nothing really happens. Because it's conformal, the only thing that's important is the size of the space relative to the size of this thermal circle. Okay, so I can draw a similar but not quite the same diagram where I have the temperature on one axis, and I have, instead of the size of the space in units of lambda QCD, I just have the coupling. Okay, so I have a real coupling in this theory that, that actually controls physics. And at large coupling, then the picture is that there is a phase transition, a first order deconfinement transition, that just goes to a constant in units of the inverse radius. Okay. That's right. So the gauge theory on flat space is like the large temperature limit of the gauge theory on S3, because you can either shrink the circle or expand the S3, and that's the same thing. Okay, so... Let's see, but I think in this example, it should be the same. Yeah. Okay. So good. Okay, so this is a theory that actually Witten talked about early on in ADS-CFT and showed that you could actually understand the phase diagram by using the gravitational side of the theory. Okay. And it's probably a story that most of you have heard, that if I vary the temperature, so vary the size of this thermal circle towards the boundary of the space-time, then for low temperatures, okay, so for larger circles, then the gravitational action is minimized by basically just the original ADS solution. So we imagine that basically at low temperatures we have this global ADS and it's excited by some thermal gas of gravitons. Beyond a certain critical temperature, there's another solution with the same asymptotics that minimizes the gravitational action, and that is a large ADS black hole. Okay. So this is another example where we know something about strong coupling. In this case, we really know it analytically as long as we believe ADS-CFT, and you have a transition between thermal ADS and the large black hole. Okay. So I think it's quite interesting to ask the same question that we've been asking about the weak coupling end. Okay. So this falls into my general class of theories that everything is the same as I said. So we have a first order transition at zero coupling. You can compute the transition temperature. It's actually only off by 30% from the strong coupling transition temperature, okay. Roughly a factor of 3/4. but then we can ask what happens as you turn on the coupling. Unfortunately, I don't have a I can't report the results of a three-loop calculation, so I'll just go over some implication of the two possibilities. Okay. So this is one possibility. If we found that B is equal to zero, well, then the natural guess would be that you have a first-order transition all the way along. Okay. B less than zero, thanks. Okay. So I think that's quite a fascinating possibility because what you see is that there's a phase up here, which we call the large ADS black hole up here, at strong coupling, which down at weak coupling is really just the high temperature phase of the gauge theory. Okay, so by studying the high temperature phase of the gauge theory at weak coupling, then in principle you're studying exactly the same phase as this black hole, and so you know, so maybe you could learn something about black hole physics, or you know, if some of the physics is qualitatively similar at strong and weak coupling, then you could possibly learn about black hole physics. You know, if something like a singularity persists down here, then you might be able to learn about that. And I think Steve Shanker has kind of outlined various things that you might look for in a gauge theory to understand whether you have a singularity in the bulk. Okay. Now I think. Well, this, I mean, you know, here you would really be able to calculate anything you want in principle. So if you knew exactly what calculation you wanted to do to tell you about some aspect of the physics of the bulk, then you could just do it because we're at weak coupling. Now I think Steve actually looked at this and didn't find anything. So he didn't find his particular signature of the black hole singularity at weak coupling. So I don't know if that's evidence that this is not the right picture, but I think it's an interesting possibility that you might be able to study that phase. Okay. So here's the other possibility. Okay. Well, so this phase transition now starts at second order. So we'll necessarily have to have some kind of special point in the middle. You could call it a tricritical point where the behavior of the deconfinement transition switches character. It'd be interesting to understand what that means from the gravitational point of view. And then you'll also have, well, at least one other, I mean, so this is just maybe the simplest possibility. This third order transition could go up to infinity. I mean, it could also hit this line, or it could go, asymptote. Well, it could either asymptote or go all the way to strong coupling. And so in any case, you have at least one more phase on this diagram, which included so far thermal ADS, large ADS black hole. Now we have something else, so it's interesting to ask, what does that mean on the gravitational side? Although one should keep in mind that down here we're talking about a theory whose curvatures are string scale, so it's. Well, so I don't know. I mean, so I don't know which of these possibilities is realized. So I don't have any. Okay, so I mean, one way to answer that would be, does the flat space theory, so does the thermodynamics of the flat space theory have a transition at some finite value of lambda? And pardon? Well, I mean, so I don't think there's any evidence for or against that possibility. We can really just study it. Oh, yeah, that's right. But it could be. I mean, just talking about the free. So what we know about the free energy, for example, is that free energy is some function that looks about like this at weak coupling, and something like this at strong coupling, and it's off by 3/4. But it may or may not be a smooth analytic function all the way through, and I don't think there's any evidence for or against. So if this went off to asymptoted to a finite value of lambda, that might suggest that there's some mild discontinuity in that function in the free energy in flat space as you vary lambda. Okay. Okay, so, I'm running out of time. I'll actually just, I would like to flash a couple of more slides at you without going into detail, so I'll just show you some pictures about the most recent work, which is to look at what happens when you have non-trivial spatial topology. Okay, so in this case, what we have, when I went to do this mode decomposition before doing my calculation, what I said was that alpha, this Wilson line around the thermal circle, was really our only strongly interacting degree of freedom, and everything else became very massive as the sphere became small. Okay. If I have a torus, then I have extra light degrees of freedom. Okay. So, for example, I could integrate the gauge field around any of the spatial cycles of the torus, and that would give me some unitary matrix, which is also effectively massless. Okay. So what we might expect is that the best we could hope for is that this would be described by some multi-matrix model at small volume. Okay. So that turns out to be basically true in some examples. And so what we've looked at in detail is kind of the simplest example. So the simplest example of a space with some non-trivial topology is a circle. And so you can look at a two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory on a circle, so ask about the thermodynamics of that. Okay. Now we want to add some adjoint matter here because pure two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory is a little bit too simple. It's some exactly solvable topological theory. So in order to get an interesting phase diagram, we think about, for example, the dimensional reduction of a higher dimensional field theory, which would have some adjoint matter. Okay. Actually, we'll also think, we'll in general think about having this adjoint matter and giving it a mass as well. Okay, that'll make our analysis simpler. Okay, so here's the picture. We now have basically a couple of parameters, the sizes of the lengths of those two cycles. You could think of slanted tori as well. I'll just think about this example in this talk. Okay, but now the interesting thing is I have an additional kind of order parameter. So before we were interested in this gauge field integrated around the thermal circle. Now we could also integrate the gauge field around a spatial circle and ask about whether the eigenvalues of that are clumped or not clumped. Okay. So I have two order parameters. This gives us four possible phases, if I'm just interested in whether trace U is equal to zero or not equal to zero. Okay. If I'm interested in these more subtle order parameters, for example, whether the function, the eigenvalue distribution was continuous or had a gap, then you might even have more phases. Okay. 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 So I'll flash one example where we've actually, really understood this, I think. So I want to take my pure Yang-Mills theory. So I want to just take the dimensional reduction of a higher dimensional gauge theory, dimensionally reduced to two dimensions. That gives me some scalars with commutator type interaction. But I also want to add a mass term here. Okay, so I have an extra parameter. I have the two sizes of the cycles, and then I have a mass parameter. Okay, so three dimensionless parameters. In the limit where this parameter, this mass parameter, is very large, things become relatively simple. Okay, that's easy enough to understand because if m is infinity, then I can solve the theory exactly. If m is very large but not infinite, it turns out that I can do enough to really map out the phase diagram. Okay, so this is what it looks like, and I'll just say, so it's kind of fun because there are all kinds of different regions on this phase diagram, and each one requires a separate analysis. So I'll just briefly say what you'd have to do to get this. Out here, if either R1 or R2 is very, very large, then we're effectively talking about a non-compact one-dimensional gauge theory, the thermodynamics of that. And that analysis was done by Semenov, Zarembo, and Tirkkonen 15 years ago or something. Let's see. Quite a while ago. I don't know how old Zarembo is. So they've done this analysis, and they basically calculated a transition temperature. So basically, in the infinite volume theory, there is a deconfinement transition at some particular temperature. You can calculate that temperature analytically. It's something like one over m times log of m. Okay, so it's something particular. So this is very large radius. If both of my radii are quite small, now actually this region is actually with radii of order 1 over m times some logs of m. Okay, so it's actually something that, so actually this whole picture is going to go down into the axes, leaving only one phase as m goes to infinity. Okay, so this is where the radii are actually quite small already. And so they're small enough that I can ignore the kk modes or integrate out the kk modes. But I can't make the radii too small, okay? Because if for example this radius is too small, well that's the one that corresponded to our inverse temperature, okay? And if our temperature is too high, then we start actually what we excite are the zero modes of the scalars, okay? So these scalars that were supposed to be quite massive, well that mass doesn't really come into play very much if we're at a temperature much greater than the mass. Okay, so we should actually take R to be greater than 1 over m, but less than 1 over m times some log of m. Okay, so there's actually a region in there where I could ignore the kk modes and I can ignore the zero modes of the scalars, or I could integrate them out. And I do get exactly a two-matrix model, so a matrix model of two unitary matrices, which I can analyze, and you actually find this nice phase structure. Okay. Down here, so if one of my radii is small enough, okay, then eventually actually I just reduce to a 0 plus 1 dimensional theory, okay, and depending on the values of the parameters, I could either have just p plus 1 massless scalars, so if the temperature is so high that it's way above the mass of all the scalars, then it's just like a 0 plus 1 dimensional massless theory that you can analyze numerically to get this part of the line. If the temperature is a little bit lower, then the scalars in the 0 plus 1 dimensional theory are massive, but you have one massless scalar, which is really the zero mode of the gauge field. Okay, so you have all these different regions. They all admit an analytic analysis, and there's kind of unless something really funny happens in some small area of the phase diagram, then the phase diagram should look like this. Okay, so we have these. All of the four possible phases are actually realized, and it's interesting. So here the axes are a little bit different than the ones that I've been using for the sphere. Okay, so let me. Okay, so here actually temperature is actually decreasing as I go up here. I'm just going to switch this diagram around to make it the same as what we had before. Oops. Okay. And so you kind of get a fun looking result. Okay. So here I've now changed it so my one axis is R times the dimensionful coupling. This is actually square root of the coupling in the, no, sorry, it's just the, let's see. Yeah, so a two-dimensional theory has lambda of dimension m squared. So this big lambda is the square root of lambda. But it's the radius of the circle in units of the scale of the gauge theory. Okay, so actually, this is the same as we saw before, right? So at very large radius, we have a deconfinement transition where the temperature is basically given by the coupling in the gauge theory. So in the 3 plus 1 dimensional example, this went all the way down to the axis and it was first order all the way. So in this example with the non-trivial spatial topology, you actually get kind of an interesting result. So the deconfinement line where the order parameter trace U switches is not smooth. It has this jump. It has this. It goes exactly flat for a while, and then it comes down all the way to zero for this value. Then you have this other phase transition line. So this is the phase boundary for the spatial Wilson line. Okay, and that looks like this in these units. So one of the interesting points about this diagram is that our two order parameters that I was talking about before actually behave differently in this case. Okay, so the free energy can be of order n squared even when our trace u is zero, as long as trace v is not equal to zero. Okay, so even when this kind of spatial Wilson loop has eigenvalues that clump, the free energy becomes of order n squared. And so within this region that I would call confined based on the Polyakov loop, I have some part of it with free energy of order 1, some part with free energy of order n squared. Okay, so I think that's it's kind of cute that those two order parameters are not always the same. Okay, and then to end, I'll just flash up. So we actually also studied the maximally supersymmetric cases. Okay, so in comparison, okay, so this was bosonic Yang-Mills. We had all four phases realized. If we study the maximally supersymmetric case, this is again an example where you can get help from ADS-CFT. And so here it depends on what your boundary conditions for the fermions are. Okay, so if I have an antiperiodic boundary condition on the spatial circle, then I have, it turns out, three phases. Okay. So this part of the phase diagram down here looks like the bosonic theory, but we don't have a confined, we don't have a trace U is equal to zero, trace V is equal to zero phase. This just goes off all the way. If I make the spatial boundary condition periodic, then I actually only have two phases, it turns out. Okay, so this part of the analysis up here, this is all using some ADS-CFT analysis, which I could describe a little bit afterwards if you want. Okay, so this is two phases. Okay, it's always deconfined based on the Polyakov loop. What's changing is just the spatial Wilson line. Okay, interestingly, so this is the eigenvalues of the spatial Wilson line clumping at large coupling. This turns out to be, so in the gravitational picture, this is actually a Gregory Laflamme type transition where zero brains are going from a smeared black I don't know what you call it. It's a smeared zero brain solution to a clumped zero brain solution. Okay. Yeah. If I take both directions periodic, well, this isn't really thermodynamics anymore. It's computing the Witten index of the theory, and it's not very interesting from a phase diagram point of view. Okay, so I can actually get 4, 3, 2, or 1 different phases depending on boundary conditions and the matter content. Okay, so conclusions, well, yeah. So finite volume plus large N allows some tractable analytic analysis of these phase transitions, and if you combine that with a little bit of numerical simulation and possibly ADS-CFT, if you're talking about the very supersymmetric examples, then you can really work out the structure of a number of these examples of phase diagrams. And I think an interesting point, since we're talking about large N theories, is then to ask, well, what is there some gravitational interpretation of that? Can we learn anything about the general phases that gravitational theories can exist in if we study sort of a large class of possible phase diagrams for these large N-gauge theories? Okay, so that. Thank you. Okay. Sorry, I went a little long.
I
want to
ask you about one of your pictures.
Okay. Okay.
Exactly, you were talking about the various possible options for coefficient B. That
yes.
Simple model, and you're saying that in the case where B is which one? That, okay, the picture down here, the bottom right corner.
Good.
So what was the argument that if the statement that there's always a first order phase transmission at strong coupling?
Well, okay. So back here, I was actually specifically talking about pure Yang-Mills on S3. Okay. So in that specific example, we do know that at strong coupling, so at large volume, that it's a first order transition. Right. So it certainly might be the case that other theories have second order transitions at strong coupling. So for example, if you go to 2+1 dimensions, so just 2+1 dimensional Yang-Mills theory at infinite volume, it's not known actually whether the large N theory there has a first order transition or a second order transition. So
is this the argument that there exist theories with B less than B greater than zero?
Yeah.
Can you make a similar argument saying that there is some theory that still has this second order phase transition that
Yeah, let's see. That it continues all the way.
Yeah. And I ask because, as you say, there's two questions about that ADS-CFT type theory.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's quite an interesting question. I mean, are there actually gravitational examples of, something that where a geometry qualitatively changes its features, but in a smooth enough way to correspond to a second order transition. So I don't know. Let's see. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So. Yeah. If it were. Right. Yeah.
I mean, if you have any sort of handle, you know, on the, and yeah, this is one of the ways in which you might. I mean, in that case, for example, I don't know, even if the image is continuous, then you could hope to see that you perhaps better than the correspondence around that to that place.
Uh-huh.
I mean, correspondence was a very, you know, much stupider version of the small program.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you know, I guess one thing I didn't say, I mean, sort of related to this correspondence principle. I mean, I think it's interesting, just in general, to ask whether it is. I mean, if you do have control of the two ends of the thing, and you see a similar behavior, I mean, you know, it's still possible that something discontinuous happens in the middle. One way you might imagine, so one thing we thought a little bit about, I mean, starting with discussions with Steve Shanker and Hong Liu, is whether you can find any other kinds of, I mean, if you could find any other kinds of order parameters, so if you could find anything that you could compute at weak coupling and compute at strong coupling and find a different behavior, you know, that allows you to predict a transition in the middle somewhere. So it's not inconceivable that you might be able to at least predict in one way that you know, it's actually not continuous going from one end to the other if you could, you know, find some quantity. I mean, what we had in mind, so for example, in this possibility where, okay, so if you had this, suppose we're talking about n equals 4, and we had, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, so you're the, so, I mean, it never really went anywhere, unfortunately. Yeah, unfortunately never. But we talked about, you know, what distinguishes this particular third order transition at weak coupling, is whether the eigenvalue distribution is smooth and continuous on the circle, or whether it has a gap. And so what you need to know about are basically not just the Polyakov loop, which is just the trace or the first mode, but kind of all of the higher power. You need to know about trace of u to the n for all powers of u, all powers of u. And so it almost sounds like you could compute that. So we could compute it at this end. It almost sounds like you could compute it because it sounds like it should be related to, you know, multiply wound strings around that direction. I mean, the complication is that what you actually compute with ADS-CFT is not just the ordinary Wilson loop. It's the supersymmetric one. That actually is not a unitary matrix. Its eigenvalues are not localized on the circle. And so there wasn't really... in the end, we couldn't figure out any order parameter that we actually could compute on both ends that would indicate such a transition. So, but maybe there's something that, or if you thought harder about how to compute things in the ADS-CFT picture, then you could make some progress. But. Other questions?
Office, which is like a department of farewell, at my supermarket.